If you're ready to confront your destiny, if this is the moment that you've been praying for, tune in and listen to your cosmic cheerleader, Commander Lady Athena, for cosmic pep talks, for closet Christ. The show is the voice of the Ashtar Command. The call is for you to step forward into your greatness. Be listening on Wednesday. We have an appointment with destiny.
Greetings in the light of the Most Radiant One. I'm Commander Lady Athena, and you are listening to the voice of the Ashtar Command. This evening, we're going to continue on with a topic we've been looking at in greater and greater scrutiny, and that's what keeps us tied to this world so that it appears every morning when we wake up, they're pretty much the same. What is it that holds us in this time-space continuum? So we're going to be looking at that, and our topic tonight is the yoga of equanimity and the nature of samsara. To begin with, I would like to address a question which I'm sure all of us have asked at different times. Realistically speaking, what does it look like for the average light worker to be divinely realized, self-realized, God-realized, awake? What can we look to that would be a practical modus operandi given the life and the world and the historical period that we seem to be living in? So I would like to take this page from the Manual for Teachers, which is from A Course in Miracles. The words are by Jesus. And let's just take a deep breath and go into it as a form of meditation. And just relax. Allow all your beautiful divine essence to be present. And immediately I see a very intense purple light come in. And that is the Beloved. Wow, it's so beautiful. Allow it to cleanse and purify and transmute and lift you in your soul awareness into the higher planes. And as the Course in Miracles is read audibly, it immediately shifts the consciousness into right-mindedness, immediately aligns you with the truth of the Holy Spirit within you. So the title is, Can God Be Realized? Can God be reached directly? God indeed can be reached directly, for there is no distance between Him and His Son. His awareness is in everyone's memory, and His word is written on everyone's heart. Yet this awareness and this memory can arise across the threshold of recognition only when all barriers to truth have been removed. In how many is this the case? Here then is the role of God's teachers. They too have not attained the necessary understanding as yet, but they have joined with others. This is what sets them apart from the world, and it is this that enables others to leave the world behind with them. Alone they are nothing, but in their joining is the power of God. There are those who have reached God directly, retaining no trace of worldly limits, and remembering their own identity perfectly. These might be called the teachers of teachers, because although they are no longer visible, their image can yet be called upon, and they will appear when and where it is helpful for them to do so. To those to whom such appearances would be frightening, they give their ideas. No one can call on them in vain, nor is there anyone of whom they are unaware. All needs are known to them. all mistakes are recognized and overlooked by them. The time will come when this is understood. And meanwhile, they give all their gifts to the teachers of God, who look to them for help, asking all things in their name and in no other. Sometimes a teacher of God may have a brief experience of direct union with God. In this world, it is almost impossible that this endure. It can perhaps be won after much devotion and dedication, and then be maintained for much of the time on earth. But this is so rare that it cannot be considered a realistic goal. If it happens, so be it. If it does not happen, so be it as well. All worldly states must be illusory. If God were reached directly in sustained awareness, the body would not be long maintained. To those who have laid the body down merely to extend their helpfulness to those remaining behind are few indeed, and they need helpers who are still in bondage and still asleep, so that by their awakening can God's voice be heard. Do not despair then because of limitations. It is your function to escape from them, but not to be without them. If you would be heard by those who suffer, you must speak their language. If you would be a savior, you must understand what needs to be escaped. Salvation is not theoretical. Behold the problem, ask for the answer, and then accept it when it comes. Nor will its coming be long delayed. All the help you can accept will be provided, and not one need you have will not be met. Let us not then be too concerned with goals for which you are not ready. God takes you where you are and welcomes you. What more could you desire when this is all you need? Isn't that beautiful? So everything that we have going for us, or not going for us, all of our qualities, our characteristics, our limitations, our shortcomings, all of it is worked together and utilized to bless everyone. Yes, even your darkest and most distorted aberrations will be utilized to set others with a similar problem free. So never despair. Whatever you are, whatever you have, once you've offered it to the Holy Spirit to be utilized as his instrument in this world, everything will be useful. Every person, every event, every experience is our teacher. There's no throwaway moments. There's no throwaway events. Every person is in your face and in your life. And even the most casual encounter is there because they have a part to play. And you can see in that person a reflection of the beloved, and in that you become set free to the degree that you see that freedom in others, which is your own setting yourself free. Or you can see that person as an aspect of your ego and there reinforce the illusion. As we mentioned in our last webcast, we practice forgiving by looking beyond the illusion and realize every situation in which we find ourselves in this world is simply a projection of our own unconscious guilt, which we externalize and project onto others. So as we learn to practice looking beyond to the one, we set ourselves free. And that looking beyond in course definition means to forgive. And as we forgive, the outer externalized negativity, whatever it is dissolved. A Course in Miracles has a whole lesson on, I will forgive and this will disappear. I've been using that a lot this week, looking at different things going on in the world. And I keep reminding myself, as I look beyond, as I forgive, this will disappear. And what's so very, very wonderful to bear in mind, that as you start setting yourself free by forgiving and looking beyond and choosing to see the one, looking beyond the appearance within the illusion, as we do that, it has an effect that goes out through the whole holographic matrix. In time, space, dimensionality, it touches to all of your holographic projections, i.e. your past lives, your future lives, all those lives which are concomitant. They're all exercised in the eternal now, right now. It goes and it touches to all of them. And it heals all of them. And in fact, in highest truth, you are everyone you see. There is only the self, only the one Atma. And so you become an agency which dissolves the illusion that has kept people seemingly entrapped. And that illusion is called in Sanskrit samsara. So the ego mind, the part of the mind that believed it separated from source and judged itself for that, has conjured up all the world of samsara. And the seemingly many forms being born and appearing to die, and in the meantime suffering the scourges of duality. And none of it, beloveds, not one iota is real, nor does any of it have any effect on us. That's what's so amazing. None of it is real, none of it happened, and none of it has any real effect. But, here's the big but, we believe it did, but it's only our belief in it that accords it any temporary, illusory effect on us. We remain as God created us, in perfection, in holiness, in unified oneness, in perfect love, perfect divinity, that remains eternal. So it's just the mind that has become entrained in wrong thinking and has projected through misidentifying itself. So that's the part that the yoga of equanimity, as we practice it, will begin to heal. And in this manner, you see, we begin to end the obligatory necessity of reappearing in the same world every morning when we wake up and each lifetime. And many, many souls who probably listen to my program are at that last incarnation, or they may be self-realized yogis or adepts or master souls that have just a little bit still to work through before they can maintain that clarity of self-realization consistently. I think probably those of you that really are understanding what I'm sharing each week would be in that category, because this is not exactly a message that goes out to the masses with any great appeal, because if you examine the average person, they're very involved and invested in the material world, in making it work and fixing it and manipulating and controlling and plotting and conniving and trying to make it so. And 100%, I would say, of all of our pain and suffering, frustration and disappointment arises from these attempts to validate and to hold on to and maintain what is virtually an illusion. So, as we said in the last show, that we remember that none of this happened, and that there is no world. I remember Krishnamurti wrote a book, quite a few books on this topic, as a matter of fact. You are the world. And so this would be the concept here, that we are the world that we dream we see. And as we heal the vision that projects the world, it dissolves in its negative aspects and begins to reveal the vision of what's really behind the appearance. And behind this charade, behind this this veneer, is the face of the one beloved, is a magnificent, true universe that God truly created, that God has maintained along with all of us in a unified field. And so the awakening, the only job really in the awakening is to awaken from the delusion that there is an outer world. And, you know, when I say that, it's not about positive thinking and training ourselves to only see the good, because nothing that we see with the body's eyes is real. And there's no exception to that. In fact, interestingly enough, Jesus teaches us that the eyes do not see. We don't see with our eyes. We actually see internally what the mind has projected. And there is the split in the mind. So you'll see either through the eyes of the ego or the mind, ego mind, or you will see through the vision of the Holy Spirit, which is pure light. And light and truth and vision are one. So again, you have episodes of where, again and again, you are shown the light. You begin to, as I mentioned in the last show, you begin to see orbs of light and auras around things and flashes of light and peripheral things that coruscate at the corners of your eyes, that reality begins to insert itself within the dream, within the fogs of Maya, Samsara. The real begins to appear in. And every time something wholly real appears in, you have that flush of joy, the endorphins, the wonderful energies that cause a sense of joy and bliss begin to invade your life and your mind, and you're washed with these feelings of euphoria. And this is the evidence that you're beginning to see the real, because every truly joyous thought and feeling arises from a perception of something that is true and divine and holy. And every depressing and negative thought comes from identifying with and buying into the illusion of the divided world of pain. So I think this is very good news, because the whole mind, the mind that has been retrained and restored by the Holy Spirit working in conjunction with your willingness to forgive and release and look beyond, when you exert that willingness, the Holy Spirit then begins that process of restoring your right-mindedness, and your mind becomes healed. And then you see but the one beloved. And your experience of life is one totally unlike the average person that's living lives of quiet and not so quiet desperation. I hope you can't hear that motorcycle outside. I'm trusting that you can't. But there again, all sounds are echoes for the voice for God. So that's one of the ways that you deal with noise in the world. All sounds are but echoes for the voice of God. That's a nice way to think of it, isn't it? So, we gradually learn to live above the material identifications with body, with forms, with emotional events. And at the same time, we also participate in life. So you train yourself to be the objective observer, but doesn't mean that you don't participate fully in your life, because we have to. If we don't use the life for what it's for in this dimension, then we've wasted our opportunity. Because realization must occur while you're in a human body, or at least while you're identified with being in a human body, even though you're not in it in truth. Because you believe you are, that becomes the area that you have to work from. So bearing in mind you're not limited to a body, that you're actually the spirit, still we utilize everything in our life. We utilize as part of that gymnasium to train ourselves to hold samadhi, the equal-mindedness, equanimity, which is basically the meaning of samadhi, equal-mindedness, so that you see all things through that unified field of the one. There's only the one beloved. There's only the the divine, no matter what it appears as, there is only the truth of God. So it's important to understand the nature of samsara, the illusory world of outer appearances, and though none of it is real, because we do believe it's real, we continue to experience it. So once you understand it and really get it, I think probably it will be a lot easier for people to begin to detach, because we don't have much fortification right now in the world in which we live for reality. We're not taught in churches, we're not taught in synagogues, we're not taught in most places in the Western world anything about non-dualistic monism or Advaita. We're just not taught that. And yet Advaita, non-differentiated divinity, is the highest truth. All other philosophies that position a duality or a triplicity or a multiplicity are diversions and watered down to accommodate the darkening of consciousness as the different ages proceed. We're moving now back into the age of enlightenment, into the golden age, into the Satya Yuga. And with that comes a gradual return of the illumined mind. And as we emerge out of the darkness of the Kali Yuga and we go into the golden age, it's almost like the dimmer switch is brightening, 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 until all of a sudden, whoa, we see clearly the divine truth everywhere we look. And that's happening to so many people now. We are actually in that cycle in which we are returning to the illumined state. We're returning to those states, those high, high states of consciousness that many of us, I believe, enjoyed in previous golden ages, in previous times when we've walked with Buddha and Jesus and Krishna and Rama and the different Satpurushas. I believe that many of us have had embodiments with all of these great masters of light. In fact, I think that what happens is that from life to life, we move into different schools of consciousness and different religious perspectives and different understandings, so that we have we've sort of sampled truth from many, many perspectives. And I think the characteristic of a soul that's been here many times and had a richness of heritage is this kind of universality, where they see truth and have no problem worshiping God in any tongue, any cultural valence, any appearance, by any name. You see the one beloved wherever you go. And it doesn't make a whole bit of difference whether you're worshiping with Buddhists or Hindus or Muslims or Sufis or a group of New Agers or Native Americans or whatever. You can enter into that, the spirit of that one divine beloved that God know, that people know by a variety of names and worship in a variety of forms. And that's the way it should be. We're such a wonderful, diverse, holographic mix here on this planet Earth. This planet is so uniquely awesome because of its diversity. All the different colors and races and nationalities and ways of worshiping and living and seeing life. Do you realize that our planet, I believe, is unique in the entire solar system because of its diversity? It has been seeded by so many different races and different groups of people, and different agendas have been brought here. And why should we categorize some of them as negative and some of them as positive? Why couldn't we learn from everyone something of value, just like everything is useful in the whole mix? Let's consider all of the seeding and the programming and the encodements and whatever's gone on, since none of it's real anyway. We might as well just enjoy the whole phantasmagoria. Well, you know, did you ever see Walt Disney's Fantasia? It's sort of like that, you know what I mean? Don't make a big deal out of it. Just get into life and begin to enjoy it. And like when you're having this large buffet, pick the things that appeal to you and eat of them. And the things that don't appeal to you, you don't have to make any big deal out of it. Just move to what does appeal to you. But above all, be sweet. You know, God is sweet. I love the description of God is, God is the sweetness. The element of sweetness, just like in the element of cookie dough, when you're making cookies, doesn't matter what shape or what color you color the dough, the sweetness is one. And so likeness with, like with God, the forms and the names of God are as many as there are human beings, as many as there are entities and beings. They're all God in different manifestations, but the one thing that defines that divine ingredient is the sweetness. So God is sweet, and the devotee of God is sweet, and people that hang out with God become sweet. They become soft. They become, I like to call them lamb people. They become lamb-like, gentle, and soft. And the arrogance and the harshness and the cynical edge that, that ego people, ego-driven people exhibit begins to dissolve into this just sweet, gentle demeanor that moves through life as a gentle spirit. It's strong. It's not weak. It's strong, but it's gentle. Like Jesus is, the metaphor is used for Jesus is the lamb, but also the lion of Judah. So we become both the lamb and the lion. And the lion is that, that adherence to truth that, that roars its divinity. And the lamb is that gentle, tender, compassionate, kind spirit that is the evidence that God is alive and well in that particular personality. So that is so important. Now, as we understand the nature of samsara, kind of run through your own list of life, the things that you find yourself coming out of balance with, and see if you aren't hanging into one of these areas. These are some of the characteristics. Number one, characteristic of samsara is impermanence, change. Everything passes away. Everything in the world of time, space, dimensionality, matter, and energy is continually modulating and changing. Everything in the world of samsara has a birth and a death, beginning and an ending, or at least it appears to. Bear in mind, none of this is real, but these are the characteristics of the illusion, which is called samsara. Number three, everything has increase and decrease, gain and loss, success and failure. There's a, you're either growing or you're declining. Number four is very like that. It's the waxing and the waning. Or centrophy and entropy. Centrophy is when you're taking in light, energy. Entropy is when you're dissipating and losing that. You see it reflected in youth and old age. Again, these are illusions, but when you're invested in the ego mind's projection, these are seemingly our experience. And even though we know things are impermanent, or at least, well, maybe we don't know what's impermanent, because we hang on for dear death to things that we know are going to slip through our fingers like sand. We try in every way we can to preserve relationships, for example, but the very nature of relationships is change. You know, you marry here with the idealistic idea that you'll be married for, you know, till death do you part. Well, sometimes, I mean, my aunt and uncle were married for 60 years, and I think they were the only persons that, they only dated each other, they only kissed each other for the first time. I mean, they were the one and only in their life. But I think today, many of us are coming in with multiple lives we're living within this one. We might cycle through many relationships and many marriages and many different contexts in which we're expressing our love and our the arena of our expression. because we want to finish it up this lifetime. We want to get everything, exercise that needs to be gotten out, cleared, resolved, completed. So we're digging in, you know, with great gusto to really partake of whatever we can to work ourselves free, to see through the illusion. And, you know, again, if life gets unpleasant enough, it tends to awaken you from the nightmare. Just like when you go to sleep at night and you have a really horrific dream, it'll sometimes wake you right up. And likewise, sometimes samsara gets so intense and so shocking that it actually awakens the consciousness and it goes forth in the illumined state. Another characteristic of samsara is pleasure and pain. And this is interesting because pleasure quickly becomes painful when it's overindulged. So too much of anything will cause it to move from pleasure to pain, or it'll become a source of disgust or satiation or just outright aversion. That's the basis for aversion therapy, you know. You do it until it's like yuck. You just don't want it anymore. Heat and cold is another characteristic of the illusion. The vagaries of weather and the material element, which is subject to comfort and discomfort. And then you have the many, many forms of suffering due to attachment to impermanent states, attempting to hold on to and to resist change or to basically go against the inherent nature of samsara, which is impermanence. And any time we try to attach and keep things from not changing, we suffer. Several people this week have been very, very upset because their pets have been ill, and in a few cases their pets have passed away. And yet, you know, the minute you get a pet, if it's a dog or a cat or a horse, they have very short lifespans compared to the human being. So why would you expect an animal to live, you know, forever when its nature is to leave the body after, what, 7 years, 10 years, 15 years? You know, I think there was a horse that lived to be 30, but I think that's the equivalent of like 150 in human years. and it's rare. So we need to have a certain discerning when we have things in our life, realizing that we appreciate and enjoy them for a short period of time, but they are going to leave our lives, whether it's a husband or a wife or a child or a pet. The truth is, they're going to leave at some point. So don't live your life on attachment to any material form. You will not lose that person as a consciousness, as a expression of yourself, as the one love. No, you won't lose them, but the form will disappear. Everything that is born into form must at some point depart the form. So learning to not expect things to do what they're not designed to do. And the material world is always going to disappoint you and frustrate and thwart you when you try to find fulfillment in it, because it's not designed to fulfill you. It's designed to disillusion you. Isn't that interesting? The illusion is designed to disillusion you so that you'll wake up from the illusion. That's probably its only good quality, is that it's so unpleasant eventually you do choose to awaken. You say there's got to be another way, and you begin to really look for another way. So in the material world, there is a suffering due to all sorts of physical things, insects and injury, sickness, disease, weather, animals, your environment, you know, people, things that happen. And then there's suffering of the emotions. That would be your attachments to desires and ambitions and hopes and wishes and greed and envy and states of anger and resentment and all of the stuff that we do that makes us supremely unhappy emotionally. Then we have mental states, all the fears and worries and anxieties and dreads and concerns, judgments and confusions, insanity, dementia, all of that. I often say, I'm so grateful none of this is real. I'm so grateful I'm not a body. I'm not an emotional state. I'm not a mental state. I am one with God. I am divine. I'm so grateful that that is true. So to practice yoga, which means to be yoked or united with the divine, the very first step is to accept your lot in life and to make peace with it. Wow, I think that is so important. Acceptance is said to be the first law of spirit. The second law of spirit is cooperation. And the third is supposed to be understanding, which comes gradually, as you awaken, you begin to come into a true understanding of what life is about. And you stop looking to maintain the illusion and looking for things that, in places where they can't be found. Don't worry, beloved. Everything is as you've elected it to be, believe it or not. So let everything be your teacher. And know that all is well. What is yours will come your way. It will find you at just the perfect time, at just the perfect way. So there's no need to fret and plot and be anxious for anything. Jesus said, don't be anxious about what you'll wear, what you'll eat, or where you're going to live. God knows what you need and will supply the things that you need. It's inevitable. God takes care of itself. And once you realize that you are part of God, an incarnation of God, you're actually a divine embodiment of God, then why would you not have your needs met? Everything in nature is supplied, even in samsara. So why would you not have your needs supplied? So what is not your lot and allotment in life, you won't be able to have or achieve. So just be at peace with where and what your condition is, and make it work for you in a positive manner. You know, it's interesting. Our life today is full of so much entertainment and distraction and so many choices. But I often look at some of the lives, you know, like in Mongolia where people will live their whole life in a yurt, you know, one of those little skin tents. And maybe they'll tend sheep or something, or whatever they tend there. I guess it's yaks or something. Yeah, yaks, I guess. They have such simple lives. They don't have television. They don't have computers. They don't have anything. And yet they seem to be happy, don't they? They seem to find joy in very simple things. To us, I guess, it'd be crazy-making, but I guess it's all what you're used to. But, you know, we get spoiled by too much agitation. We're told by the yogis that the mind is like a pot of water that you're trying to balance on your head, which makes more sense in the Indian understanding than here in the West, because we don't carry pots of water on our heads. But in India, you'll see these lovely ladies carrying these large jugs of water or whatever on their heads. And you know, with their walking, of course, the water, they have to be very careful. They don't slosh the water out. But the consciousness is like a water in a vase. If you keep agitating and agitating that vase, you don't have steadiness of consciousness. And without steadiness of consciousness and steady focus, you can't really penetrate the mind to perceive the truth. That's why it's important to train the self to be still. You know, it's perfectly okay to sit in absolute silence without thinking, without doing anything, just breathing in and breathing out. I love to sit and just look at the trees outside my window, listen to the bird calls, and just watch the wind, you know, in the trees. That sounds crazy to some people, but I just love to do that. Just be absolutely empty and still. So practice that. Practice being quiet and being still. Don't be a slave to your telephones and your whatever it is you stick in your ears. Those things are, we don't have time for stuff like that nowadays. We really don't. Now is the time for those of you that are truly desirous of awakening and making this your last obligatory incarnation and becoming a fully God-realized master. It's time to turn off the music and the sounds and the TVs and the cell phones and be still. Be still in yourself. But also train yourself to move out in the malls and in the byways and in the stores and in the Walmart, wherever it is you go. But stay in that divine presence. Train yourself to do that. Use this life as an arena for God realization. And practice it so that you don't have to, quote, quote, have to have a quiet place to meditate. You don't have to have a certain condition around you in order to realize God. But realize as you move with these walking temples that walk around you that are all embodiments of the one self, begin to use that as a meditation. When you look at people, begin to look at them as, I remember Ramakrishna said that to him, people were like bags with light inside them. There were like so many bags with light inside them, or so many lanterns with light. I like the metaphor of the jack-o'-lantern that we have in Halloween. It's like we've got this light inside this vegetable. Not that we're vegetables, but it's like this outer form, and yet inside there's the light that shines out. And it's a metaphor for the forms, you know, the encasement we have around our divinity, or seem to have around our divinity, that contains the light. And the light is the truth. And the outer form, you know, we just train ourselves to look beyond that. It's some work. It takes work to really, really be an enlightened yogi, to practice the yoga of sameness, equanimity, that equal-mindedness. But what else have you got that's better to do with your time? If you're serious about awakening, if you're serious about really, really understanding who you are, why you're here, what the purpose of your life is, then you'll be very diligent in practicing these things. And if not, you won't. And you'll come around again and again until it's your time to, like a ripened fruit, ripen. So another interesting thing I've been watching is people that operate out of exorbitant fantasies about their abilities and the illusions of glamour that they wrap around what they think they are and can do. And a good example of that is the auditions for American Idol. And here you see so many people that really think they have a talent for singing, and they're perfectly horrible, which Simon is quite quick to point out and to pinpoint exactly why they're wasting their time trying to be a singer or whatever. And you might think, well, boy, that's really harsh. But I think it's kinder to actually guide people into a direction where they can have some success and fulfillment rather than to enable them to continue on with this false sense of self. It's kind of, is it better for them to live in constant frustration and disappointment, attempting to excel in an area in which they have little to no talent? Or is it more practical for them to accept the fact, leave it, and go on to what they can do? So, again, as we assess our lives and what we're good at and what we have talent in and begin to discern what was our instrument for this embodiment really designed to do, you'll find that what you're designed to do, you do quite naturally. It doesn't need a lot of, you can have some training in it, but it comes well, it comes easily, by and large. When you are meant to do something, you'll have just a natural ability to work with it. So, again, you have a particular lesson plan for your lifetime. You have a particular dharma, which is your rightful behavior, your rightful duty within that particular arena. You have your stage in life, which is appropriate. And another part of it is the fact that as the body ages, which is again, it's illusion, it's part of samsara, but to go with that natural cycle, because you'll notice that as the youth wanes and the body begins to age, there's less and less that you can do in the outer world, and you begin to turn inward, and that's part of the natural cycle. Where you before maybe were busy raising kids and working and doing all the things that you had to do to maintain a physical arena where you had responsibility, that gradually slips away as you get older. And that's why the older stages of life are so wonderful in a spiritual sense, because you have less and less desire to go into the outer world and distract, and you have less ability to do that. So why try to do what you did at 20 when you're 60? Begin to move into the naturalness of that stage of life that you find yourself in and be at peace with it. If you can't do one thing, do something else. You notice when you're deprived of one of your senses or one of your abilities that there'll be other senses that are more greatly heightened in that condition. Blind people learn to see with senses other than their physical eyes. And deaf people learn to sense vibrations in a way that people who can hear can't. And you begin to see through. It's said that the five senses are located in every cell of our being, so that we can actually see and hear and sense and tune in and touch and taste with every cell. Every part of our body should be able to do that. So when we're deprived of one area, look to see what you can do, where you're at with what you do have to work with, so that nothing ever deprives you from the fullness of what's available within that context. So as we come into acceptance and flowing with our life and the gracious allowing and being in equal-mindedness with things, we begin to move into that state known as samadhi. So some of the characteristics then that we develop as we ripen is acceptance. We have a greater degree of acceptance, which is really surrender. It's really yielding to spirit. It's really trusting God with your life. And then you have patience, because you know everything is working itself together in perfect order, in perfect timing. There's no mistakes. Everything's in divine order. And so you become tremendously patient. You know if you're delayed or you're late for something, it's divine timing. Maybe you were protected from getting into an accident or something delayed so that you would meet somebody that was part of your destiny. So you learn not to be impatient. You learn to flow with what's present. And you begin to discern more and more between the impermanent and the permanent. Is this real and eternal? Or is this part of samsara? You begin to detach from the imperative to have things. You stop that demand to have and to possess and to hold on. And you begin to let go, trusting that if it's yours, it's going to be with you. It's going to come to you. It's going to stay with you for as long as it's supposed to. And when its purpose has been served, it's going to move on. And you learn to become at peace with that. When you do these things, you find you are more loving and kind. And loving kindness becomes your natural way of dealing with people and events and situations. So often the ugliness of our ego comes out in impatience and being cross with people or being rude or abrupt. And all of that just dissolves when you come into acceptance and patience and discernment and detachment. You just naturally begin to express in a way that's more loving and more kind. And then you find more and more You live with a perspective that rides above events. You begin to live above the event horizon. And you look at it like an astronaut looks down on the earth. You look down in your life and you see things from a much greater perspective of clarity and importance. Then you develop a sense of compassion where you can actually empathize with people, actually put yourself in their position and their shoes and understand from your heart that they're doing the best they can with what they've got to deal with. And you don't rush to judge. In fact, you just relinquish that tendency to judge and criticize and condemn and just become foreign to your nature. And then you become at peace. Boy, you just really start to experience peace when you relinquish judgment. And then you'll find yourself coming into samadhi, which is equanimity and equal-mindedness. And that, beloveds, is the whole purpose of our life. That and nothing else. Just to come in to that vision of the unified one. So, I hope these have given you some good guidelines. And know that your life is your particular ashram, your particular training arena for your mastery and your Christship. And that's all your life is about. It doesn't really have any other pressing agenda. And to awaken is really the only thing that God has in mind with the life plan that he's living through you, is to awaken that portion of himself. So we'll go out chanting Anahi. Deep breath. Anahi. God evening and God bless you. Adonai.